What the heck is an ambivert? I heard you say that a couple of weeks ago and I was like, you have educated me massively.
New word for you.
Yeah.
So ambivert is, let's start by saying, well, it's not. It's not an extrovert. Or it's not an introvert. It's actually a bit of both. And I would think classify myself probably an ambivert. In other words, I really like being out and about and doing stuff with people, but I also need time on my own. So the world tends to divide into people, and we always know extroverts who want to be out and about all the time and introverts who want to spend time on their own. But a lot of us fall in the middle. That's an ambivert.
What do you think about introverts whenever it comes to their ability to network? Because a lot of people give introverts a bad crack, and I'm actually an introvert.
Wow.
So that word ambivert kind of spoke a lot to me.
So I say this, and people often are aghast when I say this, that actually introverts can be better at networking than extroverts. And why is that? Because they do it with decency, authenticity, integrity. They ask questions and they listen. They're all the skills that you need to be a really good networker. The extrovert, they don't listen. They want to talk about themselves. It's all about me, 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 me. They want to drop names, and they're consistently looking over Matthew's shoulder to find somebody more interesting to talk to.
Wow. So actually with the introvert's desire to make it not about them, that actually positions them quite well to build meaningful relationships.
Yeah, because I think, to be really good at networking, I think you've got to be a world-class listener. And extroverts don't listen, you know. They are what we call narcissistic listeners. So if I say to you, Matthew, I'm thinking of buying a car, and you say, you know what? I bought one last week. The guy wanted 20,000. I got it for 15,000. It's got a great radio. It goes miles and miles to the gallon. You've taken my topic and you've hijacked it and made it your topic. Now, people do that all the time. They are narcissistic listeners.
It's waiting for the other person to stop so you can get your bit in.
They see listening as an opportunity to plan what they're going to say rather than to hear what you are really saying.
So if you were coaching an extrovert, what would you do with them?
I'd say, listen.
Listen here, listen.
Just spend some time thinking and, be empathetic. And being empathetic actually means walking across to the other person and standing in their shoes, seeing the world from their perspective, not from your perspective. But as I said, we live in a world where most people don't listen. Mm. Most people think that listening is actually a sign of weakness, that actually speaking is a sign of being an expert, of knowing stuff, of contributing stuff. But actually, no. I think you have to see listening as a form of activity. Listening not just to what somebody says, but what they're going to say next. Mm. A lot of people miss that. Mm.
This episode is part of our ongoing series with NI Connections, where we interview an interesting person from Northern Ireland who's living and/or working overseas. Now, who are NI Connections? They are the diaspora department of InvestNI, and their mission is really, really simple. It's to connect the Northern Irish community all around the world. They put together some really incredible resources, including how to move you and your family back home if you have been living overseas, how to move to Northern Ireland for the first time, and even how to move your business or open up a new branch in this wonderful place that we call home. You'll also can find hundreds of interviews and profiles with fascinating people who are proud to call this place home. And you can check out all of these things and sign up for their free email newsletter at niconnections.com. Thanks very much. And I hope you enjoy the rest of today's episode. How would you bring something like listening into a traditionally, hard, extroverted environment like sales?
Well, I think people often mix up sales and networking. I think networking is all about getting the sale. No, I mean, that's one element and sometimes an outcome of the whole experience. But, networking essentially is what you can give to other people rather than what you can get. Now, that comes as a bit of a shock to people because most people think, I need to network because I'm looking for a sale. I'm looking for a job. So I'm going to network. And I actually come at it from a totally different perspective. I think it's actually, what can I give to these other people? How can I add value to the relationship? How can I put my network at the disposal of other people? And it's based on an incredibly simple premise in life. The more you give, the more you get. The more you give to the individual, the more it comes back to you from the network. So if you live your life like that, it becomes not just a habit, it becomes a ritual and it becomes a part of who you are as a person.
You end up putting a lot of good karma out there to the world.
Well, the old what goes around comes around, all that kind of stuff. I think if you live your life like that, it'll be a benefit to you.
How did you unlock the ability to build relationships? Like, when was the first time in your life where you realized, here, I'm actually got a bit of a natural ability for this stuff?
I don't think I did. I actually think I started off really hating networking. I thought networking was a pretty sleazy, slimy activity. It was all about flicking out business cards late at night in a bar. You know, you wake up in the morning, you find Matthew's business card in the turn up of your trousers. Where did that come from? How did I get that? What happened last night? You know, and I actually, it took a number of things in my life to make me begin to realize I was wrong. Mm. And actually, to survive and thrive, you need to build a strong and diverse network. It's not a luxury. It's a necessity. It's not a kind of a nice to have. It's kind of a must have. Mm. I missed that early on. But then a number of things happened that made me realize this is critical.
Can you tell us about some of those things?
So I got posted to work in Australia as part of my job. And I was sent out to Australia and I didn't know a sinner in the Southern Hemisphere. I mean, I met a lot of sinners since, but I didn't know anybody. And I realized that to survive and thrive, I needed to build a strong and diverse network. I just really had to work at this sort of stuff. And actually, it was quite funny what happened, because my mom's had a neighbor whose kid was in Sydney. And I got the phone number and I rang this guy and I said, could you introduce me to the local Irish business network here in Sydney? And he said, there isn't one. So not knowing anybody, I said, well, what if could we set one up? Like, you might be able to know some people. So we had a dinner and 13 people showed up for the dinner in Sydney in the rugby club down in Pitt Street. The chairman of Australian rugby then was a guy called John O'Neill. So he's part of the Irish diaspora. And we called ourselves, we decided, because we both played rugby, the Lansdowne Road Club, where Ireland used to play rugby. And then as this thing grew and in a spirit of sort of sporting ecumenism, we dropped the word road and we call it the Lansdowne Club. It's there today. It's the biggest Irish business network in any city in the world. There's 5,000 members. I mean, it's become an extraordinary success. But I learned from that another mantra, which has guided me in my life, is that nobody starts a large organization. Everything starts at zero. Mm. Everything starts at nothing. I mean, when you think about it, a 21-year-old son of a Syrian migrant in a garage in Cupertino in California with a 27-year-old pal called Steve Wozniak. This guy, Steve Jobs, created the first Apple computer. And around the corner, there was two guys, one called Bill Hewlett and Doug Packard, started a printing company with $500. Walt Disney in a shed produced the first cartoon. You know, Amazon started in somebody's front room and Zuckerberg started Facebook in a dorm. Ryanair started with one plane and 18 passengers in 1985, took off from Waterford, just about made it over to London. The first flight of Ryanair. It'll do 21 million passengers this month alone. So I love that idea. Nobody starts a large organization.
Yeah. I'm one, and you headed to Australia without a single person in your quote unquote network. Mm. And you just went.
See, I think when you're in a situation like that, you have to go like 51% of the way rather than 49% of the way. Mm-hmm. You actually have to, you know, seek out unlike-minded people. You actually have to get good at talking to strangers, you know, which is something that's really critical in networking. A lot of people live their lives spending their entire time with people that they know really well. Mm-hmm. Vast majority of the people they spend time with, they know extremely well. They've known forever. When you take on an adventure, if you like that, then you have to actually change your behavior.
Mm. So you mentioned the word diaspora. What is that?
Well, you know, most think it's something you take two of with a headache. and you know, it's a word that's become, I think, a bit more in vogue over the last few years, but it's been around forever. So it's actually two Greek words, dia meaning over and spiro meaning scattering. And it was first used with reference to the exile of the Jews from Babylon in the 5th century and was always associated with the Jews and with Israel. But now it's gone mainstream. And one of the reasons it's gone mainstream, you know, think of these statistics. In 1990, there was 150 million people living outside the country they were born in. That number today is 285 million. But technology and communications have changed everything. So think of this island of Ireland. 10 million people left this island in history. That's the bad news. The good news is 10 million people left this island in history. Because now we have what we call an empire, not built by military might or force of arms, but just the fact that so many people left this island. Mm-hmm. So we now have an extraordinary kind of global tribe. Imagine this. These are the facts. There was once, at one time, the Prime Minister of New Zealand was called Muldoon. The Prime Minister of Australia was called Keating. The Prime Minister of Britain, UK, was called Callaghan, the Prime Minister of Canada, was Mulroney, and the President of the United States was Reagan. That's one of the great global tribes of the world, which would not have happened were it not for those awful statistic of 10 million people leaving this island. So people who live outside the country they were born in are by definition members of what we call diaspora. Mm-hmm. And of course, every country's got them in varying degrees and various sizes. It's not only countries, cities have them, villages, towns, organizations have them. And I got involved in that when I took on the job of working with the Ireland Funds. The founder, Tony O'Reilly, was a wonderful man, and he had a fabulous expression. He said, "Do you think people would respond to the distant drum, the ancestral echo of a land far away?" Mm. And it was kind of unknown, unproven. And with his pal in Pittsburgh, Tony was head of the Heinz Food Company. His pal there was Dan Rooney, ancestrally from Newry in Northern Ireland. And he was the owner of the Pittsburgh Steelers, a football team, one of the great franchises in the United States. And they had this idea that maybe we could corral and engage the diaspora in the United States and get them engaged back with Ireland, particularly with Northern Ireland during those awful days. It was an unproven idea. And we had a black tie fundraising dinner in the Waldorf Astoria. You know, the great and the good came. The truth of the fact is that the dinner was so unsuccessful. The only reason we had a second dinner a year later was to pay for the first dinner. And that's $600 million ago. Back to my first point, nobody starts a large organization. Mm. Everything starts at zero, at nothing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have to admit, I'm a founder member of an organization called CASE. And CASE stands for Copy and Steal Everything. Just go figure who does this stuff well. And of course, it was the Jewish community mm-hmm. in the United States who were so aligned to Israel. And they were so successful and powerful that I actually had come up with a slogan for our organization called Peace, Culture and Charity. I thought that was great. But on the night, Tony O'Reilly, who's a very funny speaker, he said, because we're aligned, we're so interested in the UJA, the United Jewish Appeal, we're going to change our slogan to Look Irish, Dress British, Think Yiddish. Right? If you could get those three things in alignment, maybe you have something going here. And as always with Tony, he was right. He had a vision, and he was completely right.
What is it about coming from this place, being the island of Ireland, that it seems to me, and I've experienced this myself, and I also just have this impression, so that you can just kind of pluck an Irish person and drop them into somewhere, and within, you know, half a day, they've made mates with all their neighbours, they're down at the pub with the local people, and there's just this kind of magnetism around them. Why do you think we as a people, what is it about our culture or our environment or whatever, that makes us naturally good at building relationships?
You know, I don't know the answer, but I think we're all social animals in a global sense. I mean, we crave, you know, human contact, human connectivity. It's certainly true in an Irish sense that once you get overseas, very often people who were never very Irish when they were living back here suddenly migrate to this strong affiliation and strong affection.
Bobby,
are
you drinking Guinness? I've never seen you drink Guinness in your life. No, I love it. I've always drunk it.
Yeah, I mean, it is remarkable. And I've been lucky enough to see it in practice in places like Argentina. You know, like there's a hurling club in Buenos Aires.
Crazy.
I mean, you know, the Guillermo McLaughlin is this fantastic. There's 500,000 people in Argentina with Irish names. There's wineries there which have got Irish names. So, you know, wherever you go, you will find that. Ironically, there are more Irish pubs outside Ireland than inside Ireland. I was once chairman of the Global Irish Pub Network.
Were you really?
Yeah. I mean, these are things you
that
do.
That sounds
right?
Like the start of a joke.
No, it's the end of a joke. But, you know, so, you know, Italians are famous for restaurants, you know, and other countries are famous for different things. And obviously, you know, we were always famous for the pub stuff. But it is true. Wherever you go, you'll find somebody. And maybe it is just because statistically, I mean, 10 million out of the population that we had. And it happened, of course, you know, the famine, the population of Ireland in 1847, pre-famine was 8 million. The population of Britain then was 16 million, 8 to 16. Now it's like, you know, 5 to, you know, 65. So we do have this extraordinary network around the world. And that was the vision that Tony and Dan had, was to see, could we put some shape on this and could we engage these people and get them to respond to stuff back in Ireland? And they were right.
I love that phrase. Will people respond to the
distant drum, the ancestral echo?
That is powerful.
Yeah.
What is it about place that has such deep roots in us?
I think, you know, one of the things I say about diaspora engagement, it's not about a country. You know, it's about a place. And not only are you very loyal to and very fond of somewhere like Donegal, you rather hope Cork falls over, you know. And people say, oh, that's so Irish. It's not. You know, I've seen it with the Scottish diaspora. I've been working in Bosnia, you know, people from Sarajevo, you know, have no interest in people from Mostar and vice versa. And one of the fascinating things, and I was in Mostar just some months ago, the extent to which people want to come back from the diaspora and start tech companies and startup companies back in the town or the village where their parents or their grandparents were from. And one of the fascinating things, like Dan Rooney, he's not Irish. His parents weren't Irish, but his grandparents were Irish. But he is so loyal and committed. Now, unfortunately, Dan's passed away, but his family have continued it on. So it's intergenerationally, this stuff continues. And I think it's been helped by, you know, technology and communications in a sense, because in the old days, you know, when you were gone and emigrated, you were gone forever. It was all over. Whereas now you can live a hyphenated life. You know, in the old days, your geography dictated your identity. If you lived in Southern California, that's who you were. But now you can live in Southern California, but be very engaged back in Poland or Greece or Ireland. Mm-hmm. And that's an interesting kind of, as I say, hyphenated, American and Scottish, American and Polish. So you can kind of be engaged in both places. And technology has made that possible. I mean, I get calls from people from Sydney that I used to know who've read the Irish newspapers before I've read them. And the thing is, they get them online. They're 12 hours ahead of us. So they've read them before. And they're calling me up and ask me questions. And I say, I got to look at the newspaper. So I think that, you know, the world's got a lot smaller as a result of that. Mm-hmm. But I also think one of the strongest drivers in life is having a sense of belonging. I mean, we talk a lot about diversity and inclusion, but there's actually a lot of, in America, in the West Coast, you hear a lot of people talking about DIBS, diversity, inclusion, and belonging. And this sense of belonging, sense of identity. And you see it in sport all the time. I was just at a rugby match the weekend here in Dublin, 50,000 people watching Leinster play Munster. I was watching the World Cup in rugby in France. I mean, it's just incredible. People came from all over the world. So sport has it, you know. But you see it in lots of different domains. Culture has it. Business has it. You know, I used to work for IDA Ireland, and the job was to get inward investment into Ireland. So we always use the diaspora, not necessarily to make the investment, but to make an introduction, to give a piece of advice, you know, to help us find something. Because winning an FDI, foreign direct investment decision, very, very competitive. And, you know, to win it, fantastic. If you come second in that competition, even if it's by a tiny amount, you get nothing.
Yeah.
Zero. Nada. So I began to realize the notion of marginal gains. Being a tiny bit better doesn't get you a tiny bit more. It often gets you a whole lot more. And being a tiny bit worse often doesn't get you a tiny bit less. It gets you actually nothing. I'll give you an example. When Intel, you know, the great computer company, when they were deciding where to set up their European headquarters, they looked at all the European countries. They looked at Ireland and they came to us and they said, we've decided to locate in Scotland, not Ireland. And my boss, the IDA, said, why? And they said, because there's more electronic engineers coming out of the university system there. And it's part of a bigger domestic market in the United Kingdom. And my boss said, give us 1 month. And he hired a recruitment company. And the recruitment company identified 1,000 Irish electronic engineers who are working, none of them in Ireland. They're working for Nixdorf, Siemens, Motorola, Nokia, all around the world. And they were interviewed and asked, if Intel came to Ireland, would you want to relocate back to Ireland? And 80% said they would want to come back to Ireland.
Crazy.
Intel changed their decision. They said no to Scotland. They came to Ireland. They went to Leixlip. They've invested 25 billion in Leixlip. They have thousands of people working there. They've sub-supply going on. They're paying massive corporate tax. It's a phenomenal success, and it was won by a wafer-thin margin. Mm. Now, we see that in sport every day. I mean, the Masters golf is won by one shot after 4 days of golf. You see it all the time in sport. But actually, it applies to life and business as well.
Yeah.
Being a tiny bit better doesn't get you a tiny bit more. It often gets you everything.
It's really interesting. So we met at Brendan McGurgan's ScaleX conference, and Brendan's a big fan of the concept. We spoke about it off air, who, not how. Whereas if you're faced with a business problem or a personal problem, don't ask how, ask who can collaborate with me to make this happen. And what you've just laid out there is actually the WHO network is much bigger than we thought it was. It's not just, in my case, what's going on in Belfast, what's going on in Northern Ireland, what's going on in the island of Ireland. It's how can we even tap into the diaspora network around the world, where there's almost just these infinite possibilities, these infinite networks that can actually show up and make a huge difference.
In fact, we went a bit further. We actually called these people tipping agents. They were people who could nudge a deal, because very often you just needed a nudge to be a tiny bit better. So these tipping agents would give you the piece of information, make the introduction, you know, help you in some way, which would give you that tiny little marginal bit of an advantage over the opposition. Mm. And so, you know, we kind of commodified this, if you like, and made it part of our policies, is who's the tipping agent? Who's the person who can help? So back to the who, not how or what.
Yeah. How do you identify the tipping agent, and what are some ways, some, I guess, tactics that you use to get close to them?
So, you know, there's four steps, if you like, in building a network. And the first step is always research. Mm-hmm. It's finding out who's got propensity and who's got capacity. So it's actually slightly a process, and you can actually rate, and we call it rating and screening people. You can figure out people. So you do have to be out and about. So when I went to Sydney, and you know, I just had to be out and about. We always say, you know, there's nothing happening at your desk, and a bad day in the road beats a good day in the office. So I was at every dogfight in town, and I went to every business association with him. I began to build up, and through the Lansdowne Club, built up a really great network of people, because I knew that who point, the way to people you don't know is through people you do know. Mm. And it's what I call the ripple effect. You know, when you throw a stone in the water, the ripples go out and out and out. So you never know who somebody knows. Mm. So, you know, I talk to everybody. I mean, I talk to the barista, I talk to the taxi driver, I talk to everybody, because you just don't know who knows. And that's how you slowly build this thing up over a period of time. And always what you're trying to look for is diversity. Because there is this concept of homophily, and homophily is a tendency we all have, and I have it, I admit to it, to hang around with people just like us. You know, when you think about it, you're born into a family like us, you go to school and college with people like us, you play sport and go on holidays with people like us, and you marry people like us, and you produce more people like us. But that's not what the world is.
Yeah.
So look at this city we're in today in Dublin. When I was growing up, we used to call it male, pale and stale. Not a very international, cosmopolitan city. Actually, I told a joke. I was saying the other day, back then I went into a restaurant in Dublin, and I asked the waiter, what's the soup du jour? And he said, hang on, I'll ask the chef. So he goes in and he asks the chef, and he comes out and he says, it's soup of the day, right? So that was then, right?
Yeah.
You think now. So think of these statistics. 14% of the United States were not born in the United States. In Ireland, it's 19%. And in Dublin, of the working age population of Dublin, is 25%. So we live in an extremely diverse city, which is incredibly better for that reason. So here's the question. Does your network reflect the diversity of the economy you work in, the society you live in? For most of us, the answer is no. And all the research by the great houses, the McKinsey's, the Bain's, the World Economic Forum, all say the same thing. If that's the case, you as an individual, you as a company, underperform. Mm. So it is a challenge for us to build that diversity in our networks, to seek out unlike-minded people, to talk to strangers. And when you think about it, what do you teach your children from a very young age? We say, don't.
Talk to strangers.
Talk to strangers, right. And yet our children, statistically, are at more danger from friends and family than they are from strangers. And yet we have that. And, you know, there's a great book written by a guy called Andy LaPata, And he said the three great fears in life, I did the research, the three great fears in life. Number three, he said, is walking into, number three, he said, is death. People fear death. So that's only three. What are the other two? Well, number two, he said, is walking into a room where you know nobody. People hate that. And number one greatest fear in life, you must know what it is.
Tell me.
Public speaking. Speaking in public. So he says a funny, he says a funny thing. He says most people, when they're asked to give the speech at their best friend's funeral, would rather be in the coffin.
So. That's funny. I'm thinking about like recent weddings I've been to where, you know, around the time of the speeches, everyone's just falling apart. The father of the bride, the father of the groom, they're just in pieces, you know. That's crazy.
And they're just...
You talk a lot about, or, you know, it's out there kind of in the world where, you know, you need to be kind to the people that you meet on the way up because they're the people that you'll, you know, kind of bump into on your way back down.
Yeah.
You've
got
this lovely phrase... You call it sending the lift back down or sending the elevator back down?
Yeah, look, I'm at this stage in my life where I got helped enormously in Australia, in the United States, in the UK, in France, where I live. I got helped enormously by people, but I can't help them now. They're either not around or I've lost touch with them. But I can pass it on. So I think it's important for all of us, particularly at my stage, is to send the elevator back down, you know, to help people who are, you know, on their way up and they're struggling along the way because we all have something we can offer these people. So I just do. I mean, I go into schools and do it. I go into youth clubs. I do into colleges, universities. I just think, you know, at this stage, it's important you send it on. I also have a reverse mentor, you know, somebody who's a youngster in their 20s and they mentor me. I mentor a number of people. I actually mentor a wonderful Nigerian woman who came to Ireland and I asked for somebody from Africa and she was allocated to me and I met with her. And she started telling me about her university degree. And then she was telling me about her PhD in analytics. At this stage, I said, is there any chance you could mentor me?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And she said, no, no, you don't understand. She said, I'm from Nigeria. I don't know anybody.
Mm.
And you know lots of people. So what I do is I take her out to chambers of commerce and we go to business events around town. And she's fantastic. I've learned so much from her. So I think doing that kind of stuff is about passing a little bit of this stuff on and sending the elevator back down.
Yeah. And it's, what I like about that is it can be applied no matter what stage of life you're at.
Correct.
One of the things we talk about as a team is to be who you needed when you were younger. Mm. And, you know, Daniel here, who's working the cameras today, 19 years old, you know, there's loads of people in Daniel's life he can send the elevator back down.
Correct.
So many people, you know, that were in his shoes just a few years ago, where now he has the chance to be that guy.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I just think more of us should do more of it, you know?
Yeah. Mm. I love that approach, that giving approach. You know, it's a real posture of service, which I am really drawn to.
Yeah. Because I think, you know, as I said, networking is about giving, but I actually think it's not about any one big thing.
Yeah.
I think networking is about lots and lots of small things. And in fact, I have a publication called 50 Networking Tips. And there are all lots of small things. I'll give you a few examples. Like, I never go anywhere without a notebook and a pen.
Mm.
I have it in my back pocket. Everywhere we go, I have a notebook. I mean, no big deal. Because here's the thing. In every group that you're with, in any time you're with an audience or with a group, it's full of people with great ideas.
Yeah.
But they're not written down anywhere. You can't Google them. They're in people's heads.
Mm.
And the only way you can extract them is to converse with them, talk with them, and communicate with them, and connect with them. And so bring that little book. Every day I'm writing stuff down in the book. Here's another couple of tips I think are so simple, but they're very effective. Is never leave thank you naked. And by that I mean never just say thank you to somebody, because that's a kind of a throwaway generic line. But thank you for setting up this interview today, or thank you for introducing me to a friend, or thank you for getting me a cup of coffee. But being more, a little bit more precise is great. And then the third one I would suggest is, you know, try and find two or three emails every day that you return with a phone call, not with another email. And it's all the stuff I'm trying to do is to completely understand it's important to be high tech, but it's just as important to be high touch. And I think we're in a world where we're hurtling down the sort of purely tech approach, and that, you know, at one level that opens opportunities for people to use that high touch approach, because I think that makes such a difference. And as I said a minute ago, we're social animals. We crave social contact. But technology, which was designed to bring us all together, is actually having exactly the opposite effect.
Absolutely.
And it's tending to starch the humanity out of our existence.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's healthy.
Yeah. And I was thinking earlier, whenever you were talking about the diaspora and the marketplace in general, you know, from a young age, particularly in the North, we're kind of keep your head down, you know, don't stick your head above the parapet, all this sort of stuff. But actually the marketplace rewards you poking your head up and standing up and public speaking, like you're saying, talking to strangers, increasing your network. And as we are becoming kind of more siloed off, people talk a lot about polarization, people talk a lot about, you know, upcoming generations and people on their phones too much, all this sort of stuff. It just has presented this amazing opportunity if you're brave enough to take that step.
I absolutely. I mean, I think, and I don't like to dish on the next generation, but there's such a focus on electronic communication and devices, etc. I think they miss something.
He's bobbing his head along to that.
I mean, I think, you know, that piece of parental advice that you tend to hear, and I certainly think I got when I was sort of starting out after college and everything, which was keep your head down, you know, work hard, keep out of trouble, and let your good work speak for itself. It's very poor advice. Do you know why, Matthew? Because work doesn't speak. Mm. Other people speak. So other people, those two pesky little words, hold the keys to your career success. And I often quote the Carla Harris, who's the great Morgan Stanley vice chairman in the United States. She said, you've always got to remember that every major decision about you, your career, your next promotion, your compensation will be taken by a group of people sitting around a table in a room, and you won't be in that room. Mm. So how true is that? And I'm a fan of a guy called Harvey Coleman, who has this thing called the Pi Theory of Career Progress, which is kind of outrageous when you hear it first. Then when you reflect on it, you begin to think, you know, he was onto something. So what he said was that P of the Pi Theory stands for performance. He said, how well you do your job contributes 10% to your career progress. What? Oh, surely do a super job and you'll soar. Do a super job. Must be 80%. He says, no. He said, doing a super job, a job is the minimum. It's mandatory. It's expected. It gets you on the ladder. It doesn't get you up the ladder. And he said a really interesting thing. He said, you get paid on performance. You get promoted on what other people think of your potential. So now he's introducing those two pesky little words, other people. Now he's introducing an element of subjectivity to your career progress. So if P is only 10%, what is the I and the E? Well, the I stands for your image. What are you known for? You know, you need to be known, not famous. You don't have to become a Kardashian, you know, but you need to be known for something. Mm. And it's about your reputation. So what's your reputation? As Jeff Bezos says, your reputation is what somebody says about you when you're not in the room. So image becomes, he says, 30%. So that leaves 60%. So what's 60% of this career progress notion he's got? And he said, it's exposure. Who's seen you in action?
Wow.
Who's seen you deliver? Who's seen you speak? Who's seen you at meetings? Do you do visible work? Do you do invisible work? Now, it's a really outrageous theory. And yet I've been talking about this all over the world for years and years. And everybody I go says they completely agree. They might argue in the percentages a little bit,
sure,
but the concept. But if that concept's correct, it really does turn on its head, that parental advice stuff, you know? So you know, your career progress is in the hands of other people. And if they know nothing about you, you're not going to progress.
Yeah.
Fascinating, isn't it?
It's who, not how.
Who, not how. You said it.
It's crazy. Yeah. It's really crazy. Yeah. You spend a lot of your time flying all around the world, doing all sorts of mad things with governments.
Mm.
What on earth is going on there?
So, you know, I'm at the stage now where I was over 20 years working with the Ireland Funds. I worked with IDA Ireland, I worked with Enterprise Ireland. I'm trying to take all of that stuff and see, is there an interest in it from other places? And when I came back to live in Ireland after being away for a long time, I got called by loads of different organizations and countries who are saying, oh, it's really interesting what Ireland is doing, but we would like to do something to engage with our diaspora. What should we do? How should we do it? And so I started to record, I started to film, started to put together online training courses, and I started getting asked out to other countries.
Mm.
So I actually think this is one of the kind of hidden gems we have in Ireland. My mission is to make Ireland the number one country in the world for diaspora engagement. So I was out this summer. I spent a week in Zambia and a week in Nigeria. And you know what's really fascinating out there, Matthew, is that so many of the people I met in government there were taught by Irish priests or nuns, or even evangelical preachers, you know, who'd come out from Ireland and had taught them. And they feel a debt of gratitude to these people.
Crazy.
So our reputation in Africa was built on the backs of these sorts of people. We weren't a colonial power. So we have access to people at the highest level. And they all say the same thing. We want to do what you've been doing in Ireland for decades and decades and decades. We want to be able to do that. Possibly the country in the world which is the most interesting in terms of diaspora engagement now, apart from Ireland, is India. I mean, some of the great companies of the world are run by Indians. There's Indian prime ministers and Taoiseach. You know, there are Indians running incredible companies around the world at the highest level. And there's hundreds of thousands of Indians in the medical sector running SME companies around the world. And the Indians network like crazy. But it's only been a recent phenomenon. Up till the year 2002, the relationship between India and her diaspora, which is about 30 million people, was actually very negative. There was total distrust between the two and, you know, downright dislike. In that year, the Indian government, the Vajpayee government, put in place a high-level commission, and they spent 2 years speaking to the Indian diaspora around the world. And the people vented and gave their opinions, etc. And they introduced a series of changes in India. So they changed the law about owning property, about owning shares. They introduced a new passport, a thing called an OCI, Overseas Citizen of India. They start a conference every January where thousands of Indian CEOs from around the world go back. The Bharatiya Pravasi Conference every year in India. They start a Young India program. They start a No India program. And they began to begin this notion of global Indianness. And particularly under Modi, when Modi first came in, the first thing he did was go to Madison Square Garden, you know, in New York, with 30,000 Indians going nuts with him. Then he went to the Melbourne Cricket Ground, being cricket nation. Then he went to Wembley Stadium. And there was this notion of global Indianness. So they used their diaspora to actually change their global brand, if you like.
Wow.
I mean, back then you would have thought of India as maybe in a poor, impoverished country. Now you think of it as really smart, you know, terrific technology, amazing companies, strong culture, great food, music, sport. So countries can change. And I said this when I was in Nigeria with the ministers I met there, saying that you, over the next 20 years, could do this. Because a lot of very smart Nigerians all around the world, but they're not there yet, but they could be there. And I think lots of countries are thinking, you know, we have this resource. As I said, I was in Kosovo last week. What I was saying to them is that your lost actors can become national assets. Huh. And that's a very empowering thing. And the notion that there's a difference between the state and the nation. The state is lines on a map, but the nation is a global notion. Mm. I think that's fascinating. That you could be living in Brazil or Canada and be totally engaged back to your country of ancestry, origin, or affinity. Affinity is interesting. People who go and study, you know, for many years in a country. I'm very, very friendly with a guy called Stanley Kwek, who is a Singaporean Chinese who went to Trinity College, studied medicine there, went back to Singapore, became Irish consul, honorary consul there. I got him to set up the Ireland Fund in Singapore. He's engaged back with Trinity. He's given them millions for cancer research, you know, and that's an affinity, you know, connectivity. And because kids now and students now are moving from country to country, they engage with those places. So that's a resource. Mm. So I think that what we're really trying to do is rewrite that whole notion of what nationality is about. Maybe replacing it with patriotism, which is kind of love of country and doing stuff, but you don't necessarily have to live there.
Yeah. And how does that play into the whole world of philanthropy?
Well, philanthropy is an interesting thing. I mean, philanthropy is actually two words, philos anthropos, love of mankind. Essentially, it came from back to the Greek origins. I like the definition of philanthropy. You know, it's basically, you know, private wealth for public good. I like that. It's planting trees under whose shade you will not sit. I like that. We sometimes call it the three T's: time, treasure, talent. You know, everybody can do something. But the interesting thing about it now is that we're in the early days of the greatest intergenerational transfer of wealth in history. In other words, the greatest cache of money in the history of mankind is now in the hands of people who age 60 and over. And as the fella says, there ain't no roof rack on the hearse. You can't take this stuff with you.
In Ballymena, they say there's no tow bar on the hearse.
No tow bar, no pockets in a shroud, all that kind of stuff. But it is that reality and a realization that when you're wealthy, there's only three things you can do with your wealth. So the first thing you can do is you can give it to your kids. And that's fine. But a lot of people don't want to give their kids huge gobs of money because you actually destroy them. I mean, Warren Buffett, the great investor, said it's more important what you leave within your children than what you leave to your children. So if you don't want to destroy your kids by giving them excess money, the second option is you can give it to the government in tax, which doesn't seem that popular. And the third option is you can give it away. Now, you know, the reason we're at in the early days of a surge in this is that intergenerational transfer, which, you know, depending on who you listen to, it's probably in the US alone, maybe $60 trillion is going to be transferred. We would have worked in that space with the Ireland funds and supporting nonprofits around throughout the island, many, many, many in Northern Ireland. But I particularly loved the Irish American guy called Chuck Feeney, because he was a fascinating guy who was a radio operator in the American Army in the war in Korea. But when he got kind of demobbed, he went to Cornell on the GI Bill. And then he started duty free in Southeast Asia. And he ended up making an absolute fortune, which, he enjoyed, et cetera. But then he began to realize, there was a difference between joy and pleasure, if you like. He was a disciple of Andrew Carnegie, the great Scottish philanthropist, who said, "He who dies rich dies disgraced." And Chuck began to reflect on what could he do with this wealth. And it was significant wealth. And he set up a foundation and he started funding organizations in a number of countries, one of which was Ireland, North and South. So he gave close to $2 billion to education institutions in Ireland. We would not be where we are today as a country were it not for this one guy, this New Jersey guy who contributed so much. And he had this wonderful concept. He believed in, as Andrew Carnegie did, in what we call a limited life foundation. In other words, you give away your money while you're alive. You don't leave it for your descendants to spend in areas that perhaps you don't even have much interest in. And he had a lovely concept. He wanted to give away his final check on the morning he dies, because he said, "I want my check to the undertaker to bounce." Is that not a wonderful way to live your life?
That's incredible.
You know, and he was a very modest guy. I mean, he flew economy. He had a $10 watch. He, spent $8 on a bottle of wine. He just was he was a frugal rather than flamboyant consumer. Yeah. Absolutely wonderful person who did extraordinary things and always did it very quietly.
Yeah.
Wasn't looking for any names or any plaques or anything. Just did what he did.
Yeah.
And got great pleasure from it.
I highly, highly recommend reading the book, The Billionaire Who Wasn't, which is about Chuck's life.
Yeah.
And the fact that he gave, pretty much all of it away without hardly anyone knowing. It was like top secret. He had this elite group around him. And it's like, don't you dare tell anybody that this is going on.
Well, in fact, it reached the stage that, so a university would be building a great big library and the president would be asked, "Well, how did you fund that?" And he said, "Oh, I can't tell you. It was anonymous." And they'd say, "Oh, Chuck Feeney gave it to you."
That's class. Shifting gears a wee bit, just as we kind of land the plane. You said earlier you should never leave a thank you naked.
Naked, yeah.
And I feel like you do something else based on what I know about you. You also rarely send a thank you unaccompanied. So you're a mad one for writing handwritten notes.
I do. I always write handwritten notes. I mean, here's an example of one I just got the other day from a school. It was a nice card, and the headmaster wrote, and was pen and ink. So I have our own cards here, the network kitchen. Every week I'm writing, but I use a pen and ink, and I put a stamp on an envelope and I put it in a postbox. So Charles Dickens would be proud of me. It's gone back into, but I tell you this, the person who receives this won't be getting any more of these. They won't be getting from other people. Mm-hmm. It's very rare that people do that.
Yeah.
Because you're making a statement, you're putting time and effort, and you're making a degree of genuineness around the thank you. And so I'm a huge fan of some of these slightly old-fashioned things. Picking up the phone to people, sending handwritten notes, sending articles, sending books even to people. Because most people don't do that.
Yeah.
The important thing of kind of networking is you want to fit in and you want to stand out. You know what I mean? So you want to build your own personal brand around certain things. And these all, they're all small little things, but they can add up.
Yeah. It's the compound interest effect.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's, you know, like we talked about earlier, it's so easy to stand out and be an outlier because everyone else is not doing it.
They're not doing it. They're just not making the effort. I call it the ABCD approach to life, is above and beyond the call of duty. Mm. You know, going the extra mile, there's less traffic there, all that kind of stuff. You know, if you just add a little bit more value than most other people,
yeah.
Everybody's too busy. Everybody's busy being busy. They just don't make the time.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think it's worth it.
Marginal gains.
Back to marginal gains. 1% better. You don't have to be 100% better than the opposition. You just got to be 1% better than the opposition.
I'm just going to have a bit of fun here and play around. When is the last time you did something for the first time?
Well, I'll tell you that I haven't ever said this publicly, but a couple of years ago, I did a course in stand-up comedy.
Wow.
So I went to the Gaiety Theatre because they have a training course, and I did 10 weeks. And then to graduate, you have to perform stand-up comedy in a nightclub in Dublin, and you have to get 21 laughs in 7 minutes.
No way.
And to get your qualification. And that was pushing me outside my comfort zone.
Uh-huh.
So I'm a big believer. I don't know if you know Carol Dweck. He's written a lot of stuff about, you know, fixed mindset versus a growth mindset. So a fixed mindset would be, you know, where you just think, I am what I am, was born this way, ain't going to change. But the growth mindset is you identify areas where you'd like to push and learn and fail and try. Mm-hmm. So every year I have a bucket list. I mean, this year I spent 4 weeks in France on an intensive French course because I want to present the master classes I do in networking in French.
Oh, come on.
Now, I've got some French. I played rugby in France for a season when I left college, so I got some French, but that's a long time ago. But it was a great experience. And I got an Airbnb. And it was a fantastic experience on Tibe in the south of France. It's glorious. I got up with a swim, then spent from 8 o'clock till 3 o'clock in class, and then go and have another swim. So again, that was just doing something I hadn't done before.
Mm.
And the ones for next year, I wanted to learn how to use a defibrillator. I've never even used one of those. And I want to teach myself calligraphy, how to write, because I have a bad script. And I think if I'm writing handwritten notes, it's worth putting a bit of effort. So they're the ones that are on the bucket
list. That'll take that to the next level.
That's next.
Who's handwritten notes?
Handwritten notes.
Amazing. What has been the most high stakes professional conversation you've had in your career?
Well, apart from today.
There's a lot riding on this interview, let me tell you that.
I had one marvelous experience, which really left an indelible mark on me, which was, We set up the Ireland Fund in South Africa, and Tony O'Reilly, who was the founder, and I mentioned him earlier, was a really amazing rugby player. In his time, he was probably the greatest rugby player in the world. At age 19, he was a Lion and played in South Africa. But he then went on in his later life to buy and sell newspapers all around the world. In fact, this funny story, when he was in Belvedere College in his final year before the leaving certificate examination, he did no study. And the headmaster called him in and said, O'Reilly, if you don't knuckle down and study, you'll end up selling newspapers, which was actually a pretty accurate assessment of what he did. But we set up the Ireland Fund of South Africa. And because of Tony's connections, the guest of honor that night was Nelson Mandela. And it was magical. And Nelson Mandela came in to the dinner. It was 1,000 people, black tie dinner. And he sees O'Reilly sitting there, and they were friends. But Mandela says, O'Reilly, he says, I saw you play rugby for Ireland before I went into Robben Island. And I was in Robben Island for 27 years. And when I came out, you were still on the Irish rugby team. So it was a fantastic thing. And then the following week, we got invited to have a dinner in his house. And that was really special occasion. So I've never had anything quite like that before or since, you know.
I bet, yeah. Mm. Two more, both quick. If you could go back in time to a 19-year-old version of yourself and you had a couple of minutes with 19-year-old Kingsley, what sort of things would you say to yourself?
I think I probably should have done a professional qualification.
Mm-hmm.
I think university's fine and great, and I loved my time there. I think it's naive to think that 4 years of university life will see you through 40 years of professional life. Mm-hmm. So I think I would have been smart if I did law or accounting or one of those other things, but it would only have been a base.
Yeah.
Because I was a bit of a vagabond. I was a wandering minstrel. I was always wanting to be away. There is a line that says, who knows Ireland, who only Ireland knows? In other words, if you don't experience and you have never lived elsewhere, and you know it from Rwanda, from New York, your time there, if you don't do those things, you don't have a broad enough perspective mm-hmm. of where you're from.
Yeah.
So, you know, I would certainly be saying to my 19-year-old, get out and go. I say it to my kids who are in their 20s. I say, go. And particularly try and learn a language. When I was in Kosovo last week, I had 400 people at an event. Every one of them spoke perfect English. Mm. I'm embarrassed by that, you know?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it's fantastic having English, but also makes us a bit lazy.
Yeah. Final question. What has been the most significant example of someone sending the elevator back down for you?
I think I owe a lot to Tony O'Reilly, because when I set up the Lansdowne Club and I contacted him and asked him, would he get involved? And he wrote back and he said, so he said three things. He said, firstly, I'd love to. Secondly, he said, I'm coming to Australia because I'm buying newspapers. And thirdly, he said, would you be free for lunch? Jeez, would you be free for lunch? So I was going to write back and say, no, I'm busy. But so I met him for lunch and worked for him for 21 years.
Phenomenal.
So, you know, I just love the notion that one introduction, one conversation can change your life. Yeah. But they don't happen lying in bed. They don't happen sitting at your desk. I'm a huge fan of what I call funnels of serendipity, how random chance can change your life. But you got to be out and about. You got to be doing stuff. You got to be, as I said earlier, speaking to strangers, seeking out unlike-minded people, you know, putting your talents on display, building a network online and offline. You got to do stuff, yeah. You know? I remember meeting Herb Kelleher, who founded Southwest Airlines in the United States. You'd remember Southwest Airlines. It was brilliant. Yeah, it was the model for Ryanair. You know, Michael O'Leary worked for Herb Kelleher, and that's where he learned all about low-cost airlines. And I remember asking Herb Kelleher, what's the secret of Southwest Airlines? And he said, do stuff. Mm. I always remember that, do stuff. The more stuff you do, other stuff happens.
Absolutely. You know that quote, the harder I work, the luckier I get?
Yeah.
We had a guest recently say the way they think about that is they're just increasing the surface area for where luck and serendipity can happen.
Yeah, I like that. I mean, and that was the Gary Player quote, wasn't it? The more I practice, the luckier I get. So I'm a huge fan. I mean, I think planning gets you to the tip of the iceberg, but luck, chance, serendipity gets you to the bigger 7/8 of the iceberg that's underwater. And some people think that serendipity, luck and chance are just like a bolt of lightning winning the lottery. Just, you know, they just happen. I actually think they're more like a gentle wind always at your back and you can make them happen for you, but you got to do stuff to make them happen.
Where can people find you?
Here. And, you know, it's the Networking Institute. We have a website. We're on LinkedIn. I Kingsley Aikens, I'm on LinkedIn. We've got a load of training courses that if people want to dig deeper in this stuff, work with lots of corporates, work with lots of people.
Lots of foreign governments.
And lots of foreign governments. You know, just
if you're a foreign government listening to this podcast.
I'm sure there are. Yeah, so always open for a chat.
Phenomenal. Kingsley, thank you very much for your time. I really, really appreciate it.
Thanks, Matthew. Enjoyed that.
Lovely. There'll be a link to the description for everywhere you can find Kingsley. And I highly recommend going through some of his programs. You've got that great, was it 52 networking tips?
50 networking tips. We've got, you know, why companies should appoint a CNO, a chief networking officer. We've got the metrics thing, which these are the things you got to do every month. And we give you scores to make sure you can kind of build a strong and diverse network. So yeah, we've got a bit of methodology. And of course, we've got all these videos online you can adapt to.
Smashing all the goodies in the link wherever you're listening. Thanks again, Kingsley. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Amazing stuff. Just want to give one final thanks to NI Connections for making today's episode possible. You can sign up for their free email newsletter at niconnections.com, where you'll get straight to your inbox interesting stories from people who are from this place but are living and working overseas. You'll also get some really interesting insider information about best practices of how to move back home or how to start a business here and all this other really, really interesting stuff. niconnections.com. is the place to do that. And we're so, so grateful that we're able to keep this series going thanks to NI Connections support. Have a great rest of your day. And thank you so much for checking out the podcast. Cheers.